This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hi, I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat and welcome to Night School, the show that explores key themes in history, the social sciences and the humanities. Together with Sharat Kutan, we critically unpack theories, frameworks and social phenomena, the better to understand how society works. Each week we discuss a classic text, theme or an idea that we hope to shed light on the world around you. This week, Sharat, we are joined by the duo that makes Imagine Malaysia. They are Natusha Naidu and Imran Rashid. Welcome, guys. And we are going to talk about the germinal essay, Can the Subaltern Speak? By Gayatri Spivak.
I like it already. Germinal essay as opposed to seminal. And and this is the focus on language, of course. But tell us, what is Imagine Malaysia, did you call it?
Yeah, Imagine Malaysia. You want to introduce your collective?
Is that a photographic exhibition? No, what is it?
It sounds like it, but I think I'll let Natusha speak about it more because I think he's just the one that came up with the name and the whole idea, in fact.
Okay, well, so the reason why we came up with Imagine Malaysia is because basically it's actually an alternative history project, and what makes it perhaps a little bit more different from the current alternative history projects is because we are deliberately aiming at young people. So we've been very reliant over social media, and the reason why we started this off is because we are trying to increase historical literacy among Malaysian youth, which has been dwindling quite badly. And the other thing is because we believe that we need to repopularize certain narratives which are marginalized or oppressed to counter whatever we know about master and official history. And so going to the name, why is it called Imagined Malaysia, is because we were inspired by Benedict Anderson's Imagine Communities. You know, this idea of a nation-state construct being something that all of us have to believe in for it to exist, right? So, one thing for me, I see it as the idea that we see Malaysia in this light of maybe this very reductionist form, and we want to teach people more about all these things about our culture and our history that have gone kind of underrated, so that we have a deeper sense of our identity, which is more pluralistic, I guess, and more diverse.
Oh, fascinating.
Yeah, wonderfully put. I think, though, the problem of a lack of historical imagination is not uniquely Malaysian. It probably marks much of contemporary culture, you know, this idea that we all live in the present and presentism, you know, as a kind of way of capturing that phenomenon. I think it's probably much more widespread than Malaysia. But in Malaysia, we have, you know, our own kind of version of the problem, I guess.
No, that's true, that's true. And partly because I think because the word Imagine Malaysia somehow trying to signify a couple of things. First, that Malaysia is not an object that we can touch. It's not something that we can actually see on the buildings. It's a collective imagination. It gets its meaning from a collective imagination of its people themselves. So in speaking about imagination, you have a certain stories to support that particular imaginations, and those stories coming from histories. And the problem lies when those stories, those narratives, doesn't reflect what's in the Malaysian societies, the whole diversity of Malaysian societies. So we have in our mainstream histories the history of elites, the history of a certain few group of people. But then when you look at the reality of Malaysian society, we have more diverse and more characters that are not being introduced in the history.
Listeners, just to give you a clearer picture of what's going on in the studio here, Natusha and Imran are very young. I mean, I know you geared this project towards reaching a youth discourse, but you are just pretty much entering your academic careers, right? So what moved you personally, you know, in terms of your intellectual leanings to really commit to this project?
First and foremost, because I've always been very passionate about social activism in Malaysia. And I find that because being someone who reads a lot, interested in academic research and whatnot, and the reason why is I feel that academic research has more practical implications, which are very deep for people. And the other thing is because it's so, for me, I feel personally that in the surrounding that I am in, it's still a very underrated topic. It feels like this indie alternative thing. Oh, you're so hipster for, you know, wanting to go into academia or being an intellectual. So, and especially history, a topic like history, where in since secondary school, when you study sejarah, people are just like, oh my god, it's so boring and things like that. And they're just memorizing things without critically thinking. Whereas I was at that point, I'm already thinking, why is it framed this way? And what is, I feel like something is missing out in certain narratives of history in the textbook.
I mean, you've just done your A-levels. You've not even gone to university yet.
Yeah, that's true.
But Imran, you're already done your university education.
I just graduated last year, yes. 24 years old now.
And so what's motivated you to initiate this project?
I mean, it's rather personal, in the sense that I think when I was in UK, I was studying overseas there, and you look a lot of good things there happening in other people's country, and you started to grow some kind of feelings of hatred. So what's happening in Malaysia? So this sense of, you know, trying to create a distance with where you come from. But then maybe some at the end of my studying years, I realized that maybe I was getting too much of a picture that's come from the media and politicians and all those people. I think that's why I come back. I guess I wanted to, because I got an offer to study overseas, to do my master's there. But then I realized that maybe I should just go back for 1 or 2 years and try to understand how Malaysia works, bigger than what's in the media, what's in the story, what's in the news and stuff like that. Try to understand how do we got here really. And that's where I think I met Nidusha and we started to develop this project, to look at our history and understand our past.
It's a relief for me to know that some people think academia is cool. You know, I don't know who you've been hanging out with, but it gives me some hope. Now, I feel personally, and we've had a couple of episodes on this, Sharad, where we analyze and respond to the growing need for discourse among youths. I mean, there's a atmosphere that wants different narratives than what we've been told. So I think your participation in that discourse is very enriching. Now, you had your meeting recently where you actually discussed this text, right? Scanner Subaltern Speak. And it was well attended. It's about 20 people. Can you tell me how that experience was, what the reactions were like, and did you meet your objectives? Did you have the kind of critical discourse you aim for?
That's our first session for the project Imagine Malaysia. Of course, we have a different projects that we wanted to do, but because of the low budget that we have, so we wanted to start off with something simple and try to introduce ourselves in a way. So
there's nothing simple about Scanner Subaltern Speak, which I read at university 20 years ago.
Yes, I found it
an extraordinarily dense and difficult text. I mean, Spivak herself is not famed for being an easy read. I mean, I'm actually quite surprised that you would start so high in terms of the kind of theoretical density.
Yes, because we think that those who are going to come are those who are already familiar with the text, those who already like somehow read it during their PhD years and all those things. And we're hoping them to share their experiences reading the text themselves. So we're hoping the numbers of around 7 to 6 people. So that's the initial numbers that we have in mind. But then once we posted it on Facebook, what happened, we started to get more and more more like click of going and interested. So then those who are registered are almost to 20 people now. And those came and read the text prior to the event itself. So it's quite surprising and it's quite out of expectations, but it's something that I think is quite positive to look at in a way.
Yeah, the crowd was really diverse, and they kept coming in. I was thinking, okay, this is probably just it. But then suddenly you hear the doorbell ring, and people are like coming in, and I'm like, oh god, there are more people. And you know, I started getting quite nervous because of the very fact that the Spivak's essay is very intimidating in a lot of senses. Was, you know, it's convoluted, it's very dense, but you know, it's also very rich and has very crucial opinions. So that's why when we were discussing what text to talk about for our post-colonial reading session specifically, I felt that Spivak would be an interesting start because, you know, it covers feminism, it covers this idea of the oppressed, the marginalized, and I feel like, you know, it provides important, crucial tools in understanding Malaysian history as well.
Can I ask you, why not start with the historians? Why not start with Ranajit Guha, with the actual subaltern history group that produced, I don't know, was it 8 volumes of historical writing? Instead of starting with somebody who was reading the subaltern group through a particular theoretical lens, why not the historians first?
Partly because I think we're looking at a kind of trying to attract people at the same time, because if you put Ranajit Guha, I mean, maybe not many people in Malaysia actually recognize the subaltern studies group, but Spivak names, it actually appears in historical studies, it appears in feminism studies,
even philosophy, because she translated Derrida.
So that's appealing factors in itself in a way. But also I think the discussions conversations that we have is quite interesting because everyone spoke. Because despite the density of the text itself, the issues are very relevant to Malaysia. Because we have a lot of people who are being silenced, who are being muted to somehow could be part of the larger discourse of who are being oppressed and who's not being oppressed.
Mm-hmm. That's a poor thing. I think of, I actually met Ranajit Guha years ago. Yeah. And can say that he's a very kindly uncle-like character, you know. But he was grumpy when we went to the electronics store. So, but that aside, okay. So I understand you were trying to appeal to, in some sense, the kind of star quality that Spivak seems to have, right, in theoretical circles.
Fun fact, folks, I share the same birthday as Ranajit Guha.
It's May 23rd, 2 weeks.
Okay, but you know, not in terms of the year, right?
No, just bear in mind. He's 90 this year. But I do want to just build on that. This is a very widely cited essay. I can just think of at least two or three volumes just dedicated on reviewing its impact. And its theme, its question, is something that I think can start a lot of critical thinking on questions of representation and participation of those who are so-called outside history. So in that sense, I think the popular appeal helps start the kind of discussions that you want to have.
I guess for me and our intentions when we started the post-colonial reading session, it's not necessarily to get people to be very, to have that very academically vigorous understanding of these theories and things like that. But rather, it's just like to get the ball rolling for people to think about their environment, their surroundings, using this kind of knowledge. Mm-hmm. It's just to pitch in that, hey, you know, you should look into this kind of research, like look into like philosophy and post-colonialism and enrich our understanding better about our own history. That was the original intention, I think. So not so much on the technicality.
And also the model of the reading sessions that we had is really pretty much a kind of a commune way of looking at doing it in a way. So we need a certain number of people to come first, and then we kind of like try to have their own opinions. What are the texts that they like to study? Because we can show a different text, we can show some important, more vital texts, but there's less interest, and also there's less people to commit to it in a way. And we try to create a kind of a community. I mean, a small community to be able to somehow passionately look at the text and somehow move together as a group in a way. Mm-hmm. So that's the model of the reading session that we have in mind. And
sure, and maybe we can touch on a bit about the background of Subaltern Studies Group, where they're located in postcolonial discourse in general in the second part of the show. But for now, let's take a break. I think we had a good introduction to Imagine Malaysia and the objectives behind their reading group, but we'll get in more details in the text in particular after this break. You're listening to me, Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, alongside Sharq Kutin. We are joined by Natusha Naidu and Imran Rashid, and this is Night School on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, you're listening to Night School. I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat alongside Sharq Kutin as usual. And we are joined this week by Imran Rashid and Natusha Naidu. And we are discussing Gayatri Spivak's legendary essay, Can the Subaltern Speak? We talked a lot about background in the first half of the show. But now let's get into the text more particularly. Now, we know that she's situated in the tradition of subaltern studies. Maybe we can start with that. What is subaltern studies and why is it still relevant to us?
Subaltern studies is a group of historians that focusing on the history of South Asia that are somehow inspired by this movement called the History from Below, in a way, because they were looking at... and this History from Below movement started off in the 1970s. You have E.P. Thompson's writing about history of the working classes and all those people. And this inspires a lot of movements around the world. And one of them is subaltern studies, who are somehow based in South Asia. They're trying to somehow provide a narrative of history that is looking at the popular movements, the revolution from and the uprising from the people themselves, rather than looking at the elites dominating the independence period and the independent movements. Yeah. So that's basically the main ideas and the main kind of trajectory that they have in doing the subaltern studies research. Yes.
And Spivak's essay came a bit later, I think over a decade after the movement had established itself. What makes this stand out in the canon?
It's hard to categorize where Spivak is in relation to subaltern studies, because she wasn't well accepted in subaltern studies in few groups. I mean, there's a few factions there as well. We can't have a homogeneous subaltern studies group. This morning, I was listening to a lecture by Spivak, and she said that some some subaltern studies, so-called subaltern studies historians, are quite critical about her. And the whole essay is basically to criticize subaltern studies methodologies.
So what else do we need to know about her to understand, to locate this particular essay? She's coming from a feminist perspective, or is she coming from a Marxist perspective, or a structuralist perspective?
Spivak is very not just famous for this particular essay. She's also famous for translating the
Derrida's grammatology.
In grammatology, yes. So, I mean, she was one of the few authoritative translators of the French philosophical thinker, one of the greatest French philosophical thinker, Jacques Derrida himself.
Her situation, at least discursively, is interesting because, as we know by now, subaltern studies had positioned themselves as a response to Marxist historiography of the colonial context. So, one of the earliest moves made by people like Ranajit Guha and then Dipesh Chakrabarty and the rest was to say that the Marxist framework can no longer be used as a way to chronicle so-called history from below. So E.P. Thompson, for example, had set that wave, and for much of the global South was influenced by that wave. Subaltern studies wanted to say that there are very many limits to the Marxist project. What does Spivak aim to point to by asking that question? Can the subaltern speak?
And even subaltern, right? It's a position in a military structure, isn't it?
Subordinate, yeah.
Mm. Yeah. So what is the subaltern in a military structure?
It's the lowest of the rank, I assume. It's the inferior rank within the military structures, yes. But I think where Spivak got it from is from Gramsci, where he wrote the word subaltern to replace the word proletariat in his famous book, Prison Notebooks. So, yeah. So the reason why he used that is because actually it's quite dangerous for you to somehow project a kind of a Marxist leaning in Italy back in those days. So he used the word subaltern to replace the word proletariat, those who are being oppressed in a way. But of course, Spivak got it from there, you know, and also he got it, it's already being used by subaltern study groups already. But what she was trying to point out is that subalterns are not equal to popular uprisings or popular or the people in very general sense. They are the lowest among the people who are being oppressed and who can't have a voice to voice out their own sufferings and their own problem because of the existing discursive nature of the system that we live in at the moment.
What would be an example of a subaltern?
I think that, we discussed this during the reading session as well. And I find that the movie Jagat exemplifies the theory of subalternity really well, because it puts us in this, we are watching like the main character Apoy, who is in this isolated situation within his family, and this is exactly what Spivak talks about, like all the subalterns are kind of, it's not just one big collective group, and because they are all going through different problems, or like most of them going to some abject poverty or focusing on their own issues, that they can't come together and basically have this peasant revolt. And this is what she implies in her essay. So in the same way that there's this vicious cycle that we can't come out of, and in the case of Jagat, you actually see Apoy, even though we see education as this beacon of hope for Apoy to come out of his suffering, in the end it doesn't actually happen because of how the discursive system is. You know, he keeps being in this cycle of violence and poverty and vice, pain and things like that, and that's how I feel it really exemplifies.
I mean, subaltern, she never really defines in a positive light, and that's what we have to know about Spivak. I think Spivak defines subaltern in a very negative sense, in a sense that you become a subaltern if you can't actually have a voice. You know, it's a very negative way of putting it in a way. And when I was reading the essay, I read it almost 2 years ago. The one that I have in mind, of course, is we can debate about this later, and of course, Spivak have their own example, her own example of what is the example of the subaltern in India. But when I was reading the essay, I imagine immigrants in Malaysia, because I think we have a forum, we have discussions, we have a lot of things going on, talking about the rights of the immigrants, talking about how we should treat them, but they were not there to voice out their own concerns. It's not their perspective, it's our perspective in how to treat them and how to make sure, how to place them in these larger societies that we have today.
Possible to use the discussion about subalternity and transpose it onto a contemporary population that in fact might have all kinds of resources to have voice, as opposed to figures in history, you know, groups in history who are only in some ways approachable through colonial texts. And I think that was the, in some sense, the job of historians, right? These are people who no longer live today. An Apoy is in a lumpen, he's marginal, but he could be met in the streets today and you could talk to him. I mean, that's right. I mean, in on a most literal sense. But for the historian, they do not have the English working class of the 18th century to interview. Right. So yes. Is there a difference? I mean, are
I think it also applies to the real life. Because, for example, I mean, when she meant by you can't speak, it doesn't necessarily mean in a very literal sense. I mean, obviously, if those dead people, you can't speak. And those dead people, those the marginalized group have no resources, no evidences for their voice to be recorded and somehow being preserved in the evidence, in the archaeology archive. Yes. But also, I mean, if you are, I think it's more clear if you look at the example that she have, actually. So she was looking at the woman as the sati practices. And I think Natasha can explain more about the sati practices. But if in the real life context, even though you are basically those, if you are a subaltern in a sense, first you don't know you are subalterns. When once the historian in this context is trying to reach to the poorest among the people themselves, first, these historians will see them as subalterns, but they don't speak as subalterns. They don't have the subaltern consciousness the way Marx defined as a class consciousness in a way. So even their voices are somehow being represented, having this proxy to define themselves. So their identity is somehow being reduced, being objectified. So their own expression, their own kind of a personality and totality of their own individuals, it's not something that represented in the subaltern kind of a studies group, because they are the one that represents it, they are the one that frames it, and because they are somehow in a very dominant positions to do it. And in her essay, I think she mentioned this way, that to pre-peasant is basic to master them, and to master them is somehow to represent them in a sense that your own individuality, your own kind of a personal stories are somehow being undermined throughout the particular process itself. This is not to say that you shouldn't do it in a way, because I think she was quite clear that this is a risk that you have to take. But she's trying to somehow show you the limitations of it, that if you are basically a subaltern who have no voices, who are somehow being at the lower part of this particular kind of a discourses, any attempts to represent them cannot represent them at its totality in a way. And this is, I think, is one of the where she somehow insert the constructionist methodologies to it, because every labels and categories or words, the words that we use, for example, women and oppressed, there are many layers to it, and every attempt to represent them in our kind of a mainstream discourses always fail to capture the whole part of what exactly is happening on the ground in a way.
What do you think of the work of the subaltern? I'm not very familiar with them, but I think of them essentially as historians, and what differentiates them, say, from sociologists or anthropologists who are working with the contemporary, is they work precisely with the archive, they work precisely with historical records and what's left, right? Is it possible to use these theories and labels in that kind of way? I mean, would you say, for instance, that migrant workers in Malaysia are the subaltern in the same way? Yeah.
I wonder about the same thing, because I read this a while ago and I remember there were all these perplexities I couldn't resolve in that discussion in class. But I do recall wondering what it means to be outside history, because that's the fundamental concern of the subalterns, right? We still, when we do write history, work with certain frameworks in mind. And for the longest time, the most compelling framework was historical materialists. And in that, you have this saga between the working class and the bourgeoisie, which, for the most part, from what I recall, influenced Indian historiography. Now, because India did not develop, and this is Ranajit Guha's argument, right, that it did not develop the bourgeoisie that's so-called progressive in the kind of Western sense, you cannot just transpose the same framework that Marx provided into India, then you have a problem then. How do you represent those who are from below in a historical framework that's very much rooted to particular context? And I can see that concern being reflected in this essay, right? Because she is saying, as soon as you subscribe totality, as soon as you place certain agents in the picture of the history of capitalism or something like that, their agency is no longer theirs, but is absorbed in our narratives and then our cultural and historical baggage. My only question here is, I get it, she says that we have to represent at some point in a strategic manner, but I don't necessarily see what's at stake. You know, I mean, I'm old-fashioned in that sense that, you know, you still have nonetheless a proletariat. Proletariat must do something, must organize. So you put aside your, you know, cultural issues and you get together and see your subject position. And that requires consciousness raising. That requires telling the woman in rural India.
Rajasthan, whatever. Yeah. Throw herself on a funeral pyre.
Yeah. So, and I think
this is false consciousness. Stop. You don't need to burn. You don't need to burn with your husband.
Because I just wonder, is this just like an academic reflex, people who are, you know, privileged, who are trying to overcompensate for their place, therefore they're extra sensitive or something, or is there something else going on, you know?
I do take it. It's so important to talk about the question of representation, the means by which representation is produced and reproduced. If you are going to enter into a project like Imagining Malaysia, because we can be naive and we have been naive, especially in the creation of alternative narratives. Either we just take the left alternative narrative because it's not the dominant one, or some versions of the left alternative without necessarily subjecting it to the kind of rigorous interrogation it also requires. You know, it becomes valuable just for being alternative, right? And that's happened, I think, with Fahmi Reza's
50 tahun sebelum mereka.
Yeah, right.
Sorry, 10 tahun.
10 tahun sebelum.
That's too far fetched.
too far back.
Yeah, yeah,
and you know, and again, you know, so there is also this whole question of the criticality that's required to produce alternatives, right? If that is the ultimate objective of the reading group, to prime people to produce these alternatives.
Surely we want to engage their story. Surely there must be documentation. When there's documentation that enters particular logics of, you know, representation, so on and so forth, we don't want to just look at them, find them interesting, and then leave them alone, right? The idea is we do want to document. The question is, what's the process, right? How do we include them in the process of coding history?
Because for me, I think I see the concern that Spivak is trying to show is that we need a certain form of a certain reform in our education, our understanding of human rights and justice and whatnot. And I feel this is amplified by, not so much in this essay, but later on when she does discuss her, or clarify her work, since people have a lot of misunderstandings or they feel that she needs to speak up about what she has written in the essay. And that's how I felt that I truly understand what she meant by this necessity to criticize or being more sensitive. Because when she talks about this need to give the subaltern a voice, and she's a strong believer in education, even though she says it's a slow process and things like that, she goes down on the ground, she's teaching children and, you know, in the rural areas of India and things like that.
I think one of the main critiques of Spivak is that, you know, she said about education, she said about all of these things. I mean, is she not reproducing the very same thing that she criticized in a way, because he's trying to spoke for the subaltern in certain degrees, if you like. But again, that's only works if you somehow frame the essay as a kind of a strong critique and strong critique and try to demolish the whole structure of subaltern studies and any attempts to represent the subaltern. I think Robert C. Young, C.J. Young, put it very nicely that her works are a kind of an intervention. Like, you know what? It's a kind of like a, it's kind of a, the red lights in the red lights, you know, on the street, on the traffic. I mean, it's kind of, it's a brief pause that we have to reflect at the moment. Who are we missing? And these things, this kind of a subaltern figure, need to constantly have in our minds when we're engaging with a lot of other poorest and oppressed people in their own context, if you like. Because of that kind of a figure that we have in mind, it's allowed us to often revisit back who are being missing. Because even though we try our best to represent as much as we can those who are oppressed, but by having the subaltern image, at least it allows you to pause for a while and who are now missing.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's a useful heuristic consideration, you know, when documenting, doing history in particular, to know who's left outside our notion of history. But in Malaysia too, you know, especially as uncertainties are intensifying, identities are being politicized, I can think of a lot of people who are left out that I find very troubling and upsetting. Like, I mean, I'm sure the person who joined ISIS feels left out from the system. You know, I mean, I'm not trying to belittle, I'm just saying that when we think about what's outside, we have to be ready for, like, really confronting different modes of thought. Exactly, and I think in that sense, it's a very, very useful reminder. Well, before we end, we typically have recommendations. What do you have in mind for our listeners to look up?
I would recommend reading the essay. I mean, it's a 40-page long, but there's an abridged version, 5-page long, to get the sense of it. What are the things that she would like to see? And of course, I mean, other than reading the essay themselves, I mean, you would like to as well engage with the subaltern studies materials like Ranajit Guha, Pata Chatterjee, and all those people. They write brilliant essays, especially the one on... This is another essay that I think is quite important to read as well, is because it's being written after the Spivak's essay. Ranajit Guha on the historiography of in colonial India.
I think I would suggest... I find that Nation and Narrative would be an interesting read in relation to post-colonial studies. And yeah, Nation,
that's by Homi Bhabha.
Homi Bhabha?
Yeah, yeah. I honestly think that for Spivak's Can the Subaltern Speak, that I hope that when our listeners do actually... decide to take it up and read the essay, don't get too intimidated, because just go to shmoop.com and it's S-H-M-O-O-P and look up for their deconstruction.
You mean abridged and simplified executive summaries?
Doing the rigorous work?
I think it's a good...
accompaniment.
Yeah,
right,
a good... it complements the reading when you don't understand certain things and you want to get an idea of certain themes. Yeah. So it helped me, so...
I don't have a recommendation. Except maybe to myself to pick up the essay again, because it's been so long. Both the Gayatri Spivak's essay as well as the one that you mentioned. I'd love if you could post some PDF version of Ranjit Guha's essay.
Yeah, I can send it to you.
Yeah, I do have, and I have picked up in India the several volumes of the Subaltern Studies work. Mm-hmm. Not Spivak as such, but it's sparked again an interest in that. So who has time these days to read anything?
Your comment on critique is very interesting, Sharad, because we're discussing this as Vivek Chibber's book was released last year. He had a very legendary debate with Pata Chatterjee.
Yes.
And that's on YouTube. It's in response to his book. The book is called Postcolonial Theory and the Spectre of Capital, which really looks at the entire subaltern studies canon to give it a Marxist critique. It's been widely reviewed and it's generated a lot of discussions on whether or not subaltern studies can be seen to be a viable radical alternative for history from below. And this video is really good. So just go to YouTube and Google Vivek Chibber and Pata Chatterjee and you'll see the debate, and it's just epic.
How do you spell Chibber?
C-H-I-B-B-E-R. Yeah. All right. We have to pause here, but we do want to follow your work. So Imagine Malaysia is online. It's on Facebook, correct?
Yeah, Facebook.
Do you have a Twitter account?
Not yet, like but not hopefully yet. In the long run, maybe, yes.
And what's next on your list to cover?
We're working on a lecture series now. I mean, we're hoping that somehow we can actually assemble resources to produce a lecture series. Not us, I mean, we can't talk about any of those things, but we would like to invite all the lecturers and academicians who work on this, focusing on those characters that are being somehow marginalized in history, yes.
Wonderful. Sharad is on Twitter, as usual, at Sharad Kutan. You can email Night School, bfmnightschool@gmail.com, or look us up on Facebook. Just type BFM Night School in the search space. And yeah, share your thoughts, comments. We always look forward to hearing from you. Once again, Imran, Natusha, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for inviting
us.
You're listening to me, Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, alongside Sharad Kutan. This is Night School on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.